Richard Russo's memoir, Elsewhere, primarily concerns his mother. There is another main character in the book, and that is the town of Gloversville, New York. It is a community that has appeared and reappeared under different names, Mohawk, Empire Falls, in various Russo novels, the prototype of his decayed towns in upstate New York or Maine. After 8 works of fiction, including Empire Falls, Bridge of Sighs, and Nobody's Fool, the Pulitzer Prize winner now turns to memoir in a very funny, moving, and surprising account of his life, his parents, and the upstate New York town they all struggled, variously, to escape. It's a great pleasure to welcome an old friend, Richard Russo, back. Thank you very much for being with us. It's always a great pleasure.
Great to be with you again, Joe.
You know, one of the things I found fascinating about this book is it answered a lot of questions for me because the two of us, you and I, have done a few events together. And at various times during the Q&A portions, people will ask about Gloversville, usually people from Gloversville.
Yeah.
and you seem hesitant. And I always wondered about that hesitancy. And this book answers a lot of those questions.
Yeah, it does, doesn't it? And I've been very aware of the hesitancy. I think I may have told you at some other time that I was at the New York State Writers Institute, almost a decade ago now, and Don Faulkner, the writer who runs that institute with William Kennedy, asked me one day a very straightforward question at the end of an interview. He said, just why don't you live in upstate New York? I mean, it's just such an obvious place for me to live, given all those upstate New York towns that I write about. Just, you know, what the hell are you doing living in Maine, you know? And it really brought me up short. And I felt that same, even then, hesitancy to go into what seemed to answer the question would seem, you know, to take a book. And you know what? It did.
It seems, and this comes toward the end of Elsewhere, where you start to describe your interest once again in this place, which ultimately ends up being another book that kind of brings you down this path.
Yeah. And this was a book that I warmed to in a way after I started writing it. I actually interrupted the writing of a sequel to Nobody's Fool to write this book. I didn't want to write it. I got kind of not exactly talked into it, but the editor of Granta one day was driving along the thruway and saw the exit for Gloversville and said, God, you know, Richard Russo used to live there. And he was planning this magazine, special issue of Granta magazine about going home. And so he contacted me and said, do you want to write about Gloversville and really call it Gloversville? And I said, well, if I don't have to go there, if I can just stay home. I started writing about it mostly because my mom had recently died. She'd been much on my mind. And I thought, God, this is going to be just so, so painful to do. And at times it was. But at other times, once I started to warm to the task, I really felt, I just felt a sense of almost euphoria of being able to finally talk about some things that I had been, as you said, very, very reticent about for a very long time and for probably insufficient reason.
When you decided to look at the place, then it seems that you realize the connection between, as you say, the connection between the place and your mother and, quite frankly, her hatred for the place.
Yeah, which was, as I say in the book, it's perhaps the earliest opinion that I'm aware of as a child was my mother's loathing of the place where we lived. Her sense that in order for me to have a chance in life, I had to get out of there. And for her to have the kind of life that she wanted, she envisioned getting out of Gloversville as a quest for freedom, and she wanted out desperately. She loved her parents, my grandparents. She loved them that more than she could express. But she was living in the same house with them, and at times she felt like, in order to be her own free woman, she had to get out of there. She had to get out of her marriage to my father. And for her, the town itself, Gloversville, seemed to her to represent in some way that she could never quite articulate everything that was holding her back in life. If she could somehow escape this town, then and only then could she be happy. And it was that opinion, this first opinion of my young life, you know, that I was so well aware of, almost pre-language, but certainly by the time I went off to kindergarten, by the time I was five, I was very aware of her desperate longing to be elsewhere, anywhere else.
So your mother divorces your father. You move into a flat that is owned by her parents. Her father is a glove maker in Gloversville. So it's sort of going against, she's fighting all of these things, but these are all the forces in your life and her life.
Yes, and because her feelings about this town, despite the fact that they were wildly contradictory. Whenever she left Gloversville, she tried so desperately to get out, but whenever she left Gloversville, she immediately saw it as home and as her safety net. But that paradox, the central paradox of her life, I believe, her need to flee and also to return endlessly on this loop, manifested itself for me in a very different way, because I knew that in order to love my mother, I had to hate Gloversville. The problem was I didn't. I couldn't hate it. That would have been like hating my grandparents. That would have been like hating my friends and my relatives who lived around the corner, my cousin Greg, to whom this book is dedicated. Growing up there, I loved the town. I loved our neighborhood. I loved our lives. I loved everything about our lives there. And yet, that was something I had to always conceal, because it was tantamount to some terrible disloyalty that, as a 10-year-old, I certainly never could have articulated, but which I felt nonetheless.
During the time, and you write in the book that there is a point of your memory of thinking of Gloversville not as a depressed place, but as a place that was thriving. You remember that point.
I sure do, and remember it vividly. Remember those walks that I used to take. What seemed like such an astonishingly long distance was probably, you know, about 400 yards from our home on Helwig Street. I remember walking on weekdays sometimes or weekends with my grandfather down to the local dairy where we would pick up a quart of milk and some of those red-skinned peanuts that he used to call peetles. And then later in the week, my mother worked so hard. She worked Monday through Friday, her 8 or 9 hour shift in Schenectady at General Electric. But then, of course, she had the hour commute on each end. And by the time she got home, there were still things for her to do. But on weekends, we would head down to down Main Street. And I can remember just being lost in a sea of people, and trusting my mother to get us in this sea of people where we needed to go. Crossing Main Street was, the street was clogged with cars. And the next time I felt anything even akin to that would have been years later when I went to New York City with my father, coming out of Grand Central Station, being in a sea of people and not knowing where you were going, that sense of being at risk just because there were so many people there. It's strange for me now, but that's kind of what Gloversville, you know, with its population of, at the time, probably 22,000 people. Gloversville felt to me like a child, felt to me like New York City, felt like being in the middle of Manhattan, unable to move because there were just so many people there.
So a real turning point in the story comes when you're ready to go to college. You are admitted to the University of Arizona. You buy a Ford Galaxy. You get ready to make the trip. And in what is a very funny section of the book is Mom comes with you.
Yeah. That doesn't happen to every kid who's going off to college, does it?
No. And you have to you have to hook up the U-Haul with her stuff in it and head south. At what point did you know she was going along for the ride?
Well, she kept the secret as long as she could. Ultimately, she had to tell me, you know. But she kept the secret from me for just as long as she possibly could, in part because she didn't want to tell her parents, I think, that she was flying the coop. They would have objected for all kinds of reasons. They were not convinced that she was healthy enough to make the trip. She suffered from what was pretty clear to them, some sort of nervous syndrome. They thought they would have argued strenuously against against her making this trip. And she told them what I thought was the truth at the time, which was that she had a job waiting for her when we got to Arizona. But of course, she didn't. She was basing that little fib, white lie, I think she would have called it, on the fact that she had once had a kind of casual conversation with someone from the Phoenix branch of General Electric that, gosh, you know, if she was ever out that way, she should drop by. And so she decided that she would be out that way and she would drop by, which she did. But no, she, as a matter of fact, in the writing of this book, well, that was one of the things that was so interesting about it, was when I started writing the book and telling the story of that journey, I began to realize that not only was her going kind of a surprise and a secret, so was my going there. I didn't realize as a kid that the reason that she was leaving all those Arizona Highways magazines around the room. I didn't realize that when I was talking about going off to college, thinking about maybe being an archaeologist, that she was suggesting not only that archaeology was a wonderful field for me to go into, but also that all the best places to go were in the Southwest, and especially the University of Arizona. So in a way, for at least a couple of years, I had been lapping up these clues. And certain things weren't making an awful lot of sense. Like, you know, when I got my license, I'd only had my license a few months before we embarked to Arizona. But I hadn't had my license very long. And when I announced that I wanted to buy a car, you know, for my last few months in Gloversville so that at last I'd be able to drive and have some fun with my friends and all of that, I was stunned when she said, yes, absolutely, you should get a car. Because, of course, we would need one. How else were we going to get to all the way to Tucson without one? So it's funny, the way I write my novels is to find out how it turns out, because there's so much that I don't know when I begin one. And the writing of this memoir, which I expected would be very different because I was telling my own story, and I was telling my mother's story, and all of it was going to be based on stuff that I knew to be true. But as I actually started writing the book, I discovered that so much of what I thought was true, the more I thought about it and the more clearly I looked at it, turned out not to be true at all. And so there was this part of the reason that I enjoyed the writing so much once I got going was this wonderful sense of discovery. I was discovering my own story. I was discovering my mother's story in a way that I hadn't looked at it before, and also discovering Gloversville again after all of these years, after all of these books that I had written about it, discovering this place all over again, its hold on me, its hold on my mother.
You write in the book that she needed me at least emotionally all the time. You go on to write, she'd never really considered us two separate people, but rather one entity, oddly cleaved by time and gender, like fraternal twins somehow born 25 years apart. What is that like for a 19-year-old kid in college to have that, for want of a better term, baggage?
Well, strangely enough, it's not as bad as it sounds when you just described it. It's not something I would wish on anyone. On the other hand, It's strange how normal things seem to people who don't know what normal is. All those years growing up, the first 18 years of my life lived in Gloversville in what now seems to me to be a fairly strange set of circumstances, given my mother's nervous condition. None of that struck me as all that unusual back then, in part because I was an only child, and I didn't have anybody to compare notes with, and my grandparents weren't talking. It would have been a betrayal for them to suggest to me that my mother was anything other than completely emotionally healthy, and so they never did. And so, I mean, really, right straight through my 18th birthday and this trip to Arizona, nothing ever struck me as all that unusual about my life, about my mother's life, about our lives in Gloversville. And I took that sense of normality with me to Arizona, even when it was becoming increasingly clear day after day after day on the road that things weren't normal at all. But in terms of my psyche, I continued to make them normal. And whenever that sense of normality got violated too much, I kind of in my own mind made it normal in an odd kind of way, saying to myself how lucky I was, really, to have a parent, considering that my father and mother had separated when I was so young and then divorced when I was in high school, how lucky I was to have a mother who was so devoted to me, far more devoted to me probably than any other mother of my acquaintance, the mothers of any of my friends who had, you know, different kinds of lives and different kinds of devotions. They were devoted not just to, you know, to a child, but to all of their children and to a husband and to probably parents, whereas my mother was devoted only to me. And as unnatural as that sounds for an 18-year-old to think, when I reconstruct it, that's as close as I can come to describing what it felt like. And so, you know, a couple of years after that, when my father, seated drunkenly, and he was no drunker than I was, on a bar stool, when my father said to me in a kind of off the cuff way, "You know your mother's nuts, right?" I mean, he could have just as easily knocked me off the bar stool with a straight right cross. I mean, nothing like that had ever occurred to me. That, yes, there were times when things seemed kind of out of whack, a little nutty, but abnormal. I was 20, 21 years old before that occurred to me. In other words, I was a slow learner, Joe.
Upon marriage, did that offer some checks and balances in the guise of your wife Barbara, who really in this memoir and obviously in your life put up with an awful lot?
Oh, there's though I try to think of ways every day to repay her, there is no way to repay what she did. And as you talk about normality and the lack thereof, my marriage to Barbara introduced into the mix a whole different set of circumstances. I now had to be devoted to someone other than my mother. My mother had to share me with another woman, this pretty girl, this wonderful girl that I had decided to fall in love with. But beyond that, there was, of course, Barbara's family, who immediately recognized that something was wrong and that my mother's not only devotion to me, but her need for me to be there and to be there for her all the time and the threat of her coming unglued if any of that changed. Of course, now the drama had to play out with a whole different audience. And so, yes. My marriage, my being part of another family, which had its own, you know, my wife's family was, you know, there are no perfect families. And, right. And my wife's family presented its own set of unique challenges, but it also presented another entire reality by which to gauge my own relationship to my mother, my own family, the first, 18, 19, 20, 21 years of my life.
So when you hear those words from your mother, it's you I need, it's terrible here, and she wants to be closer to you. This not only affects you, but it affects your wife and it affects your family.
Yes, as my mother's, as she grew older and her world as a result of her nervous condition, her anxieties became narrower. Her need for me to be present and close became magnified, as you might expect. But by that time, of course, we had it was not only Barbara and me; it was also our two daughters, to whom we had to introduce this whole odd circumstance that they were going to be a part of, because of course they loved their grandmother. Their grandmother loved them. But they were also quick studies, as their father was not. They were quick studies. And so there was the balancing act, trying never to undermine their devotion to their grandmother, while trying in some ways to explain her and to make sure that they understood that their grandmother would say things from time to time that might strike them as odd, and that it was fine for them to understand that, but also fine for them to love someone who was utterly devoted to them as well.
When your mother passed, a doctor told you after her death that she suffered from obsessive compulsive disorder. Do you think it would have made a difference had you had a label, a diagnosis?
A difference to me, because despite that day when my father looked at me and said, "You know, your mother's nuts, right?" That was the first time that anybody had ever said anything, and of course he wasn't offering a professional diagnosis; he was just offering a throwaway line. Had I had a professional diagnosis, it would have been helpful to me to know what I was dealing with, and I might have tried some different strategies. By not having a diagnosis, I just kept trying the same strategy over and over again that always worked in other circumstances but never worked with my mother. I don't think, however, that it would have made much difference to her. One of the terrible things about suffering from obsessive compulsive disorder is that one of the few mental illnesses in which the sufferer understands perfectly well that something is wrong. Most people who are mentally ill don't have that sense of themselves. They think that everything's wrong with everybody else and with the world. People who have some of the worst case scenarios of obsessive compulsive disorder, hoarders, people who really cannot leave the house at all, people who have to wash their hands 75 times a day. The thing that all these people have in common is that they know perfectly well that something is wrong with them. There's just nothing that they can do about it. And I think that was true with my mother, too. Even if I had told her, you know, "Mom, I think that what you're suffering from here is something that is treatable through therapy," all you would have had to do is say the word therapy, and that would have been the end of that discussion. I think that the walls that she had built at that point against the possibility of anyone knowing that anything was wrong would have prevented her from seeking any kind of help.
Richard Russo's memoir is Elsewhere. It is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after Garrison Keillor. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.